In America, we forget how old poetry is. Dunya Mikhail, an Iraqi poet, explains how ancient as well as traditional Arabic poetry, such as Al-Mudi, influences today's poets.
What we write is actually similar to the Sumerian poetry, which was the source, the beginning of the river. Now, the Al-Mudi, the traditional, is the one that is branched away from this river. It's not that we are breaking it. We are going back to the original.
Dunya Mikhail talks with New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart about how mythology and current events overlap in her 2014 book, The Iraqi Nights, today on New Letters on the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. As a poet and journalist raised in Baghdad, Dunya Mikhail struggled with censorship while living under Saddam Hussein's regime. Forced to flee Iraq in 1996 after the publication of her poetry book, The War Works Hard, she received the 2001 UN Human Rights Award for Freedom of Writing. Her second book, a poetic memoir called Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea, won the 2010 Arab American Book Award. Now living in Michigan, she's an Arabic special lecturer at Oakland University and the co-founder of the Mesopotamian Forum for Art and Culture. She talked with Robert Stewart while in Kansas City for Rockhurst University's 2015 Midwest Poet Series. Here's Dunya Mikhail reading the last section of the title poem of her third book, The Iraqi Nights.
In Iraq, after 1,001 nights, someone will talk to someone else. Markets will open for regular customers. Small feet will tickle the giant feet of the tigress. Gulls will spread their wings and no one will fire at them. Women will walk the streets without looking back in fear. Men will give their real names without putting their lives at risk. Children will go to school and come home again. Chickens in the villages won't peck at human flesh on the grass. Disputes will take place without any explosives. A cloud will pass over cars heading to work as usual. A hand will wave to someone leaving or returning. The sunrise will be the same for those who wake and those who never will. And every moment, something ordinary will happen under the sun.
Dunya Mikhail reading from her book, The Iraqi Nights, for New Letters on the Air. I think the article "The" is probably important in the title of that book, which is, of course, a reference to the Arabian Nights, or 1001 Nights, as it's otherwise known. And there are references in this book of poems to Ishtar and Scheherazade. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what inspired you to frame the book of poems in this way.
These female characters in our Iraqi tradition and also in general the Arabic tradition play a great role, these characters of Scheherazade and Ishtar. The way I recall them to my writing is through each one is different. The Scheherazade, her role in the Arabian Nights is a storyteller who was able to survive through these stories and, you know, escape her death. So I was thinking to borrow that through this writing, that survival be possible, as if these poems are the life we lived before death. Ishtar, or in the Greek mythology, Inanna also. This character fascinates me in her duality, in a duality of everything. She's the goddess of war and the goddess of love. She is both masculine and feminine.
I think you touched on it very well, because in the classic epic poem Gilgamesh from Arabic tradition, she's incredibly fierce. And when she's rejected, she says something like, I think in the poem, she's going to bring the dead back to life and that the dead will outnumber the living, if I remember right. And it's that fierceness that you kind of catch both aspects of that pretty much in all of your poetry. I see you as kind of blending this literary mythological tradition with very personal tradition. Very much a love story is woven through many of your poems as well. And I wondered whom you identified with, if you identified with Ishtar in your mythological poet journey?
Yes, I mean, in a way or another, I think all human beings, they have that duality in them. I mean, and it depends also on the circumstances, etc. And this is a, you know, it might be in a different field subject. But this resort to mythology, sometimes in my poems, goes the other way. For example, in the poem Three Women, also in the Iraqi Nights, it's written after hearing the news about three women in Cleveland, Ohio, were kidnapped and left in the basement for 10 years. From 2003, now this is not the mythology, these are actual women, but as if in the poem, turning it back to mythology, they're talking about a stone, as if these women were a stone and just thrown there, frozen for 10 years. So this is the other way, like turning a reality into a myth, and rather than now the other ones as myth, bringing it to the reality.
I wonder if we might hear that poem.
Three women. That stone is three women. It was cast there 10 years ago. No one touched its pain. No one heard it wail. No one saw a dream of the sun. Feathers scattered everywhere, its memories. Another night on the way to the cages, and the stars, dead eggs glistening, don't know the secret of the stone. They move slowly above the neighbors who enter their homes and turn off the lights. Another morning will rise beyond the three shadows crammed inside the stone.
That was Dunya Mikhail reading Three Women from her book, The Iraqi Nights, published by New Directions. You're listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Robert Stewart. This whole business of your poetry, working with mythology, I think is pretty interesting because while you were a poet in Iraq, you wrote a memoir, Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea, which dealt with a lot of mythological figures. Am I right to assume that you were doing that to disguise your anti-war, anti-dictatorship sentiments?
Yes, that writing, it's actually led directly to my leaving Iraq. After it was published, and there was a lot of interrogation and questioning in my office by people, and that I had to leave right away. But what attracted the attention of censors and the officials, there was a passage highlighted by the censor to have it removed from that text. And then when I said, sure, small, you know, it's short, if I remove something, it's... And he said, well, I am going to keep my note and it's up to you. And I don't blame him, of course. He was on the safe side. And a friend of mine warned me that, no, it's risky, don't do that. But I kept it. And a lot of other symbols in that book. But that passage in particular, I borrowed the Zeus character from the Greek mythology. And I depicted him as a cruel leader, bringing wars from his box and storms and all that. So that was a Zeus character, what was questioned. And they did ask me about that in particular. Who is that? Who did you mean by that? And who's this leader? And there were other passages also, anti-war and dictatorship. And not taking sides in the war was a big deal in that place, in that time. They want the writers to take sides. And not only take sides, but their sides.
I think you actually said that not taking sides was, for them, an act of antagonism against the established government.
Yes, it was. It meant a lot for them. The reason for that, you know, if we think about it, why there's censorship there, why the censorship was so strong, not only that we're punishing writers who don't take sides or don't praise their deeds, not only punishing them and the best case scenario send them to exile, but on the other hand, they were giving big awards to those who were mobilizing soldiers to go to war, or they were praising the, what they call the revolution and party and all that. They were giving them big awards like houses and cars, etc. If we think about it, this is all tell us one thing, is that they have fear. They have fear from writers and the influence of their writing. The written word played big role and still plays big role in the Arab society. It shapes the opinion of readers, of others. And that's why they had this fear from writers and wanted to protect themselves, to win these writers on their side. It was a political action.
Yes, we see that over and over again in totalitarian regimes in which the writers must sort of promote the agenda of the state. And evidently, you know, they just get very conservative when they're in power. It's pretty interesting. There's this phrase that you used in some of your writing about that kind of poetry. What's the phrase again?
Yes, they called it al-adab al-ta'bawi, which means the literature of mobilization. It was as if it's a genre of writing, and there were readings, and they had certain poets that have titles like Prince, or like they give them titles with these awards, and they are known for this adab al-ta'bawi, and they used to have these big festivals and take us from our offices as audience, and they would lock the doors, you can't leave. And not only that, like you have to listen to these. Sometimes one of the poets would, for a change, would read something personal or free verse, and that was a big relief when we were hearing that. We would.
Yeah. Well, you also wrote in one of your essays that actually American poetry became more influential for the new generation of Iraqi poets than the traditional was Amudi poetry.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Which is more formal, more prescribed kind of verse. Maybe you can say a word about that too.
I studied at the University of Baghdad in the Kulliyat al-Adab, which is like College of Literatures. Mm. Maybe liberal arts is the one here. So in that was an important stage for my writing. That's where I met the other students who were also writing, and the poets of today were students with me then. So we were exchanging these books. And this classical Arabic poetry called the Sha'r al-Amudi is very strict. It has long tradition, and it has rhymes and rhythms, and it has 17 patterns called buhur. And buhur also means sea, the seas. So each pattern is a sea. That's why in my title, I mean it, The Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea. On one hand, is that also it is that breaking away from that tradition.
Oh,
from
very
the also,
interesting.
So also an addition.
Very clever.
Thank you.
Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea, which is the memoir that you wrote, originally in prose, was kind of broken up into verse lines when you published it. But it's the memoir that got you in trouble so much, I suppose, when you were still living in Iraq. And I wonder if you'd read just a little passage of that first part, which is the part that you wrote and published during the war in Iraq.
One cold morning, I knew it was the day I would die. So I prepared myself completely for death. I finished my last poem and arranged my coffin and bought flowers to be thrown on my grave. Death and I, we both like flowers. I said to myself, have I forgotten anything before I die? I remember that I had not put the chessboard away, and I was afraid this would make the king angry with me. So I arranged each piece in its place on the board. At dawn the next day, I saw the chessmen running for shelter, and I thought, why should we hide in shelters when the sky is clear? We curled up and hid in a corner without knowing if we shivered from cold or from fear of chemical weapons. In a white room, the snow inside us touched the harsh darkness. The walls rose around us bit by bit, and the ceiling lowered above our heads. Everything merged together and rolled into the shape of a missile aimed at my head, which had transformed into a wastebasket. And before I could apologize to the missile for the vast emptiness inside my head, my brain tissue flew out like wounded sparrows carrying my memories. The sparrows stood in a triangle on my head like a tombstone.
Dunya Mikhail reading from part one of her book, Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea. This is Robert Stewart on New Letters on the Air. We were talking about your use of mythology to describe certain comments that you might make about war, but there are certain things in Diary of a Wave that are pretty direct, even though what I really want to ask you about is your use of imagery, which I think, especially in part one, is pretty astounding. I mean, to apologize to the missile for the emptiness in your head is crazy. It reminds me a little bit also about a mutual friend of ours, the poet Brian Turner, who has a fairly well-known book of poems called Here, Bullet, in which he's challenging the bullet to come, you know, kind of that bravado that he puts forth, directly addressing that bullet. You're addressing the missile.
That section in particular, this was, you know, the 1991 Gulf War there in Iraq. They called it the U.S.-led war. So I was there. So we were in a room prepared by my mother, because shortly before that, my father died. And my mother and we were five kids. I'm the oldest. She prepared a room for us, small like this. She called it the room of war. If this starts, because we didn't know, they were saying it's going to happen, the war will not happen. And she prepared it. She said, right away, you hear the siren. Usually we hear the siren beginning of war. That's the room we are in. And she explained to us how it's important not to leave for any reason that room. She even built a small, like what works for bathroom. She said the reason she closed it because there was fear of chemical weapons. She closed everything. The window, she put tape on it so if it breaks, it doesn't hurt her so bad. And the other important reason for her was that nobody should leave, that we either die together or live together. She's afraid that, yeah, if one leave in that moment. So I was a chess player in Iraq, and I even represented Iraq in an Olympiad international, and I had a rate officially in chess. Then I stopped it for a number of reasons. Not only that, I was so occupied with poetry, I wanted to use the time for poetry, not to, each chess game would take hours from me, because when it's a serious official one. And also the idea of chess, with all the soldiers, the pawns, the soldiers protecting a king, one king, I was already having a complex from that in the reality with that, what was actually happening. So I didn't want to do that as a game also.
Interesting.
So I stopped it.
Yes. The other thing that I found reading Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea, I know you wrote it originally in prose, and that your publisher or your translator wanted it to be published more in verse form. I can understand that impulse, because it is just an amazing lyrical experience to read this part one and part two of that book. And whether it should be prose or poetry, I don't know, but I do know the lyrical power of those lines is pretty wonderful to read.
Yes, actually, the translator, Elizabeth Winslow, I think that she translated this with big love. Didn't think of it as poetry, but to be honest, I think that was successful. She did that in part one. Part one, the reason was poetical, is that I used metaphors to hide some meanings there, and it was safer to write them that way than just naming things, than leaving those metaphors say their real things.
I noticed the different stylistic approaches between part one, which you wrote in Iraq during the war, and part two, which was written after you were in America, living in Detroit. I assume that's where you wrote it. And there is a stylistic difference. Did you write during the turmoil, the actual battles going on around you, when you were writing that poem in Iraq?
No, I was more reading and more trying to see if we are going to survive this, because that war that lasted 40 days, here they called it, I think, Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. Maybe you saw how in the TV we were shaking, like really we were in the house, in that room, and we couldn't believe how our house didn't fall on us after all the shaking of it. And after 10 days, we took the car. It was so bad that my mother followed the other relatives to the north of Iraq, to a village of our ancestors there. And that was another experience that I also wrote about in the book. And then we came back to our house. We saw it was actually one of the walls was down, was broken between us and the neighbors. So it was all like one guard and instead of two. And we saw cracks on the walls. And when we came back, so it was, things were running between these bombs and all that. And that reading, and when we came back and being in the, having a book and on our bed after all that experience up north, and it was such luxurious just to read. So I wrote it after the 40 days when things were stopped. We had a break for 1 year before the other war. And during that year, I wrote it.
Part two of Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea has a little section in it of you arriving in America after you get out. And I wonder if you would read that section, which I thought was very effective.
We descended to Detroit, and the stewardess wished me a good day. It was not a matter of one day I wanted to reply. At customs, I was escorted aside. An official asked me questions and flipped suspiciously through my passport. She couldn't believe I had gotten a tourist visa from beneath the ruins. They took my fingerprints many times and photographs of me. I was not sure if I was supposed to smile. Was I a famous poet or a criminal? The official stamped my passport, and another mistake was made. She stamped it May 1997 instead of May 1996, giving me a year and 3 months instead of 3 months. Maybe she liked my fingerprints, which can be traced to pencils and tears. One day my fingers will cover the eyes of my friends in Iraq again, and I will ask my friends to guess who was behind them. In baggage claim, my suitcase revolved alone, as confused as I was.
Dunya Mikhail on New Letters on the Air, reading from part two of her Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea. It intrigues me because you obviously were a journalist working in Baghdad, and maybe just the journalism part of you wanted to document thoughts and ideas and experience in that. It reminded me a little bit of Carolyn Forché, whom I think you know, and a very famous poem of hers called The Colonel, which she wrote not as a poem at all. She was just being a journalist. And I think it's an interesting phenomenon when poets sort of stop trying to be poets.
Yes, I mean, this is interesting. Carolyn Forché and you mentioned earlier Brian Turner, these are wonderful poets and people that I admire so much. But this point that you mentioned is fascinating. And now I'm thinking how this played, that the journalism really affected. Like I think everybody else who worked in this field, I can even say that, you know, best poets, they must be good journalists first. That doesn't mean they have to practice journalism, but inside them, there must be a good journalist, I think. Because in poetry, there's this problem of it can be subjective, so it has feeling, and sometimes the eye may come easily into the work. Journalists avoid that. They don't put themselves in the article. Even though they have a voice in it, they always hide behind the events. And they know how to make things interesting. They catch your attention in the first line. All these techniques work well for literature also, actually.
I agree.
So, yes.
Yeah. One of the things you said recently was that somebody, maybe I didn't get this right, but there was a line that could be drawn between the poems you wrote while you were in Iraq and the poems that you've written since coming to America. And one of the things I noticed about The War Works Hard is that a lot of the poems have a kind of sarcastic or ironic attitude. And even in the opening part one of Diary of a Wave, there's a twist like, hooray, they found the bag of bones, you know? And even the title poem, The War Works Hard, is ironic and has a kind of an attitude to it. Is that part of what you mean by the change in the quality of your poems that you have written since coming to America? Or how would you characterize that?
No, I don't think that is the change. I think it's the same style. But there is that line that you're talking about. There is a change in the mode somehow, in the figures of speech themselves and the amount of these metaphors. I never forget a friend from Iraq who wrote to me. He was so honest to say that, Dunya, you were writing better before. So he loved those poems from before because he loved those metaphors. I think they work for poetry. But on the other hand, an American friend told me, reading the Iraqi Nights, she said, I like this quiet tone. It's more quiet. It has more diversity of themes and voices. I don't know. I think, in my opinion, it's not the style that changed, but the way of presenting things, maybe it's heavier before with more layers and more metaphors for a reason to avoid those censors.
Yes. When people say, oh, you wrote this way in Iraq, and now you write this way in America, that assumes that poets don't change and grow and mature, and they do. A style of a poet isn't the same forever. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing for a poet to experience. I think that many of the poems, one of the observations I had about the Iraqi Nights is that the direct, almost simplicity of the language takes a tremendous amount of courage. And I'm saying that as a writer myself, and how difficult it is sometimes to find that simple image or that simple moment and then just leave it alone. That takes a great deal from what I've been able to experience. And yes. In fact, I'd like to hear poems, especially from the Iraqi Nights.
Yeah. This is dedicated for my friend Lori, who says everything is happening now. The end of the world. Everything is telling me it's the end of the world. The astrologers, the deadly new viruses, the ozone layer, the ant coveting with the grasshopper, the wars and his message, cold and curt. But other things change my mind. The clouds that always know their way. The seashell that has inquired disclosed it all. The wishes tossed with coins into the fountain, and the flower waiting to happen.
Dunya Mikhail reading from her book, The Iraqi Nights, for New Letters on the Air. Are there any particular poems that you would like to add?
There's a poem at the very end of The War Works Hard. You know, you asked me earlier how the censorship, we were avoiding it. It's called Pronouns. It was published in Iraq. The person, the editor responsible for that cultural page was a friend. He was also another poet, a modern poet, and he has this responsibility. He can't publish any. It has to be safe. So he looked, he read it, and there is in it a line that general, it's sensitive. So he said, you know what, Dunya, I like this poem. Between you and me, I'm going to publish it. But if somebody come and ask you, who is this general? Say, this is Schwarzkopf. So I said, okay. So these are Iraqi way of...
See, we don't, in the United States, we don't often think of this kind of intrigue when it comes to poems.
Pronouns. He plays a train. She plays a whistle. They move away. He plays a rope. She plays a tree. They swing. He plays a dream. She plays a feather. They fly. He plays a general. She plays people. They declare war.
Pronouns by Dunya Mikhail from her first book, The War Works Hard, winner of the 2004 Penn Translation Award with Elizabeth Winslow. She also read from her other two books in this conversation with our editor, Robert Stewart, while at Rockhurst University's 2015 Midwest Poet Series. You can read more of this interview in New Letters Magazine, Volume 81, Numbers 3 and 4. And for a limited time, we're offering that issue free if you subscribe to our Quarterly Journal of Writing and Art. Visit newletters.org and look for the summer subscription special under News, or call us toll-free at 888-548-2477. That's 888-LIT-AIRS. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Today's show was produced with Timothy Larrison, Sean Weir, Coy Duggar, Nick Shea, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.